Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us for our podcast this week. We're going to be talking with Aaron Ganney. Aaron is the CEO of Behavior, a company that is using virtual reality to improve people's health and quality of life. And Aaron has a background as a chief technology officer at Humana and has served in a number of executive roles within that organization, as well as earlier in his career, he was in the financial services industry. He has an MBA from Duke University, and he shares some great insights about his career, lessons learned, and we're looking forward to our conversation with Aaron today. And Aaron, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your background and a little bit about your career?
Sure. So, Mark, I am a lifelong technology enthusiast, or many would say geek, going back to childhood. Got my first computer back in junior high school and fell in love instantly with creating experiences and applications in that space inside the computer. You know, we didn't have the term cyberspace back then, but that evolved over time. And for me, it was always magical, and have done that my whole life in my earliest jobs. And then when I got sort of real jobs and started a real career in financial services for many years, and then the last 13 years in healthcare.
That's great. Well, we pointed out before we started our conversation and our recording that you have an old computer behind you. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I do. That's a bit of nostalgia. So that device there, for the older folks in your audience, they may recognize it. It's a Radio Shack, a TRS-80 Model 3, which was my first computer back when I was, I don't know, 13 years old or thereabouts. That particular one I bought on eBay and gutted it. And it's now a very high-end Windows 10 machine in the body of an old TRS-80 just for fun. So that was inspired by the book Ready Player One.
Okay.
Which, if you're in the virtual reality space, is required reading, of course, right? And in that book, there's a lot of 80s nostalgia, including the old first computers when many of us kind of fell in love with personal computing, and that's my little piece.
Okay, very cool. Yeah. I'll have to go back and watch that movie again. I saw it once, but I'll have to pay more attention. Well, tell us just some of the things that you've learned. I know you've been a CEO for several years now, for what, 3.5 years at your current company?
Yeah, that's right.
And, tell us a little bit about that journey from you were a chief technology officer, I know, in your career. Did you move from that directly to a CEO position?
Yeah, it actually overlapped a little bit. So I mentioned I was in financial services technology for many years and was fortunate to work in small companies and big companies and do a variety of things. And then I got into healthcare in 2006 when I joined Humana, a big managed care organization in Louisville, Kentucky, and a fabulous company, very focused on health. Spent so much of our time there working on how do we help our members of our health plan get and or stay healthier. And but I had for many years, not just during my Humana tenure, this sort of unscratched itch that I wanted my own business. I wanted the opportunity to fully realize my vision of what we could do with technology in certain areas. And in my 12 years at Humana, got to a place where I really saw a gap in the market. The nutshell version is we spend way, way too much money on healthcare in the U.S., $3.6 trillion a year, believe it or not. It's about 20% of GDP. Most of that is driven by chronic disease. And if we're going to move the needle on chronic disease, we have to help people live healthier lives. So it's about affecting behavior and lifestyle. So I saw that as a remaining gap. It's still a gap in the industry, causing lots of pain and suffering, lots of overspending on health. And being a technology geek for all those many years, I knew that what was about to happen in 2016 was virtual reality as a technology was about to come out of the lab and into the mainstream with the Oculus, you know, Kickstarter campaign, then acquired by Facebook. And we finally had in 2016 consumer grade VR technologies coming to market that were going to be convenient, affordable, scalable, high quality experiences. And they're, you know, VR is incredibly psychologically powerful. It puts us in a whole different space and place and time. And we can do a lot with that by engineering experiences to really elicit emotional engagement and physiological reactions and kind of get deep inside people's heads in a positive way. And so that to me was the perfect combination of big, important problem that needed solving and really kind of new opportunity to apply not just VR, but also cloud and analytics and mobility and so on, but a convergence, this new moment in time where we can really reinvent behavioral health. So that's what I set out to do.
It's very cool. Well, I watched a TEDx talk that you did, I don't think that long ago. And that was, it was interesting just to hear just some of your thoughts around that and health and how that even using the entertainment industry as far as maybe doing some joint things with them around virtual reality. Talk a little bit about that, just some of the interesting things that are happening.
Sure. Yeah, that was fun having that opportunity to do that TEDx. The idea that I was sharing there is, you know, our health is so important to us, particularly if something big is happening in our lives, right? Like if you think about a healthcare experience where you felt a lot of emotion, it was probably because something either really good or really bad happened, right? It's not the stuff in between. It's not like, oh, I got my annual checkup with my doctor or, you know, my colonoscopy or whatever. Those aren't the fun, exciting things, right? So it could be really great news, a new birth, a new addition to the family, or on the other end of the spectrum, really bad news about our health. At those extremes, health is the most important thing in our lives, right? For our own well-being, as well as the thing that can take those we love away from us potentially, right? Or bring them to us. And what struck me is, in spite of just how important that is to us, there's very little emotion and storytelling in healthcare. As we look at the state of the art around trying to educate people about how to improve their health, it tends to be very dry and clinical, right? It's like, let me teach you about how your blood pressure works and these are the numbers you should hit. And it's all sort of very clinical and dry and boring. And yet you look at, I'll call it Hollywood generically, right? But the creative class of people creating movies and art and music and storytelling. And that's where we get on a daily basis engaged in these really emotional highs and lows, and whether you're feeling excitement or love or fear or anger or whatever it is, you have this incredible group of talented people that know how to engage us emotionally. And the thing I was calling for in that TEDx talk is, hey, Hollywood, sort of as a label, why don't we get that creative class engaged in this effort to help us improve our health? And then, of course, I think virtual reality, because of the emotional and psychological power of the medium, is the great place to do that in, to bring that storytelling and emotion engagement to programs that help us understand and then improve our health differently. So hopefully we can recruit some people to that cause. And I think there's a huge amount of opportunity there to get people engaged.
Great. Well, one of the questions I like to ask is, if you were able to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Aaron, with what you know now, what advice would you give him?
You know, for me, it's about, and you'll hear various riffs on the theme of do what you love. People hear that a lot, right? And it's sometimes hard to know, like, what does that really mean? We all have bills to pay and we got to go out and get a job. And, you know, a lot of times we call it work for a reason, right? Every day isn't necessarily full of fun and enjoyment when we're out making our way in the world. But for me, it built up over time. I read a book, gosh, something like 6 or 8 years ago. The author's name is Todd Henry. The name of the book is Die Empty, which doesn't sound very uplifting. And Todd jokes about that in the book, like, oh, what kind of title is Die Empty? But for me, it was the right book at the right moment. Todd's message is at once sort of simple and yet profound, which is you have a limited amount of time on this planet. That's true for all of us. Someday our days are going to run out. And yet we spend so much of our time imagining that that is not so, sort of not thinking about our mortality and not thinking about it's all going to end sooner than we'd like. And when I think about the 22-year-old me, I didn't do a terrible job of taking risks, but I was still pretty conservative. You know, I had a new wife and a mortgage and, you know, you got to get paid. And so you stay on the somewhat safer pathway for your career, whatever that means for the individual. And I would just say the earlier in life that you can embrace that notion, that you have limited time here. It's important that you make your best contribution to the world, do your best work, get aligned with what you're passionate about as early as you can, because that's how you're going to have the biggest impact on those around you. You're going to create the most value and you're going to be the most satisfied. So that's probably the biggest piece of advice that I would give 22-year-old me.
Any advice that you received that looking back you would have ignored now?
It's in a general category of people who would try to be helpful by describing sort of the way the system works, whatever the system is, right? This is how a career path works in information technology, Aaron. You got to do this first and then this and then this. This is how you start a business and do fundraising. This is how you create a new product. Like, it's intended to be helpful, but there are lots of people who will tell you about the way it is all expected to go. Mm-hmm. And while I would encourage people to pay attention to those things, learn from the patterns of, you know, those who have gone before you, don't put too much weight on those patterns and the way that it's supposed to go. Because if you follow in other people's footsteps too much, by definition, you're not going to be creating your best mark on the world and the unique contribution that you can bring. So it's like, pay attention to all that, but then say, I'm going to forge my own path.
Yeah, that's good. Who are some of the mentors that you've had in your career or in your life that made an impact on you?
Well, there are a few that come to mind. I'll tell you their names first and then tell you a little bit more about them. Three come to mind. Brian LeClaire, who up until just very recently was a senior VP and chief information officer at Humana. He's just retired, so congratulations to him. But he was my boss for 12 years at Humana. Brilliant guy, as self-described good Catholic boy, he would say, and just the most trustworthy, the most do it the right way, the most let's take the extra time and do it right kind of person I've ever met. And no question, just learning how to be thoughtful, think several steps ahead, go the extra mile to do it right, whatever it is. Maybe it's about understanding the people you're about to engage with. Maybe it's about going deep to first principles around a problem you're facing, whatever. He stands out. And it's really all about, taking the extra time to do it right, whatever that means. Earlier in my career, a fellow by the name of Steve Bohm, who at the time, we worked together at First Union, a big bank in Charlotte, which became known as Wachovia. And Steve was a business partner of mine and was sort of never satisfied with status quo, always pushed the envelope, very creative about business, about changing our operations, how we did things, about how you engage cross-functional teams of people. So sort of a hard to keep up with, but uplifting person, right? So it's all about challenge and bringing a team forward in ways that we couldn't do on our own. And then the final I would mention is a fellow named Alec Persinski, also a boss of mine back in my First Union days. And what I got from Alec at the right time, and this was pretty early in my career, was a respect for and disregard for the norms of organizations and culture. So he sort of taught me to, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, pay attention to patterns and norms and the way things are done. And then have a healthy disregard for them and find your own path forward, find the creative new way. And there are many others, you know, those are three that stand out. John Williams at CSI, there are others. We all have a lot of folks. And when you get to my age, you know, there's many, many people that I have to thank that I wouldn't be where I am without them. But those three stand out for me.
Now that you've been a CEO, what was the transition like? And maybe some that are listening are just moving into that CEO position. What are some things that you wish somebody would have told you before you became a CEO?
For me, it's CEO is a title many people might aspire to. You know, it sounds impressive, CEO. It means a lot of different things, right? Bruce Broussard, the CEO of Humana, a $50 or $60 billion company, has a very, very different job from me, right? You, to compare us, it's like, it's not just apples and oranges, it's something broader, right? So as a title, it doesn't mean a lot necessarily. It's very much dependent on what kind of organization are you running. Mm-hmm. But at some level, you'd say, well, there is this commonality, I think, which is you are the person who needs to make sure that it's all coming together. And that is more than anything else about aligning and integrating people. You know, your team, your staff, your culture, your partners, the market, regulators, suppliers, you name it. Yeah, so that's the key. CEO doesn't mean anything by itself, other than the buck stops with you, and you better be paying attention to all the signals and particularly all the people that are stakeholders in your world.
Got it. Tell me, you mentioned about kind of culture and teams, which, you know, I think that's an important part of a CEO's job, is putting the right team together and making sure the culture stays healthy. Tell us a little bit about that and just some of the lessons you've learned around that.
I would say throughout my career, and I've worked in very, very large organizations right down to my little startup, right? So organizations with 3 people, with 30, with 300, 30,000, and 150,000. And what is consistent across those, there are many things that are completely different around organizational challenges and process and various cultural dimensions. But one thing that's very consistent is the people who know how to treat people and are positive in their interactions are consistent. And the people who are kind of jerks and make it harder for everyone are pretty consistent as well. And so I think that I have seen at various times organizations put up with inappropriate or poor, you know, sort of bad behavior for far too long, when they feel conflicted about, you know, well, I'm getting a lot of good things out of Mark. If he just wasn't such a difficult person or didn't make life so miserable for his colleagues, that would be better. But gosh, I don't know how I could do without him. So they put up with it too long. And I think that culture is so vital. If we've brought the right people in, they are aligned with the mission of the organization. They're aligned with what they're best at and they're passionate about. If we can get those things lined up and they're feeling really engaged and empowered, wonderful things are going to happen. You're going to build better products, take better care of your customers, make a bigger mark on the world. What can get in the way of that more than anything is challenging workplace culture, colleagues who are not helpful and productive and sort of operating in good faith. And that must be dealt with. It's not necessarily that those people are always bad people. They could be in the wrong place. Could be the wrong fit for them culturally. They need to be somewhere else in a slightly different culture. Or sometimes they just really need some lessons on how to treat people. But either way, that to me is something you can't compromise on.
Any favorite interview questions that you use?
Yes, definitely. And my favorite is, if you had a magic wand and could create any job you wanted, what would it be? Free of constraints, right? Free of worries about, well, I'd love to do this, but it doesn't pay enough money. Or I'd love to do that, but I'm not trained well enough for it, or what have you. Because for me, first of all, it's surprising how often people don't know the answer to that.
Sure.
It helps them think about, and I've said it a few times now, how do we get you aligned with what you're most passionate about and what you can, because that's where you're going to do your best work. And if you're looking for this geography or that amount of money or this title or the things that don't matter as much, much less interested in you versus if you are aligned with the mission of this group or organization.
You mentioned one book that I'm going to have to check out. Any other books that you've read or are reading that you think would be a good addition to a leader's library?
I read a lot, so there are many, but I think I would point out, and this is really about the kind of massive change that we're living through in our society. There's a book called The Singularity is Near by Ray Kurzweil. Ray is sort of a futurist and good broad thinker. And the notion, in a nutshell, without getting real geeky on you, is we're living through a time when technology in particular is changing at an exponential rate. And so if something changes exponentially versus linearly, it may seem to be changing very slowly for a while, but then as the exponent really kicks in, it starts to get to be a really, really steep curve. And suddenly it feels like everything is changing so fast and it all sort of compounds back on itself and things get crazy fast. And we're living through that steepening of the exponential rate of change curve right now. This is why in the span of a few years, you'll see dramatic breakthroughs in things like speech recognition and self-driving cars and AI and things like Amazon Alexa and Siri and mobility, and things are just changing faster and faster and faster. And if you subscribe to Ray's view of why that is, it's a moment in human history which will have profound effects. Now, when you go even deeper, what he predicts is the singularity as a notion is when we ultimately sort of start to merge with these technologies and we become, in a sense, superhuman, which sounds a little bit science fiction-y and crazy, but you could argue, well, isn't that sort of what we're doing with these smartphones, right? If they're in our hands all the time and they can change our reach to any of the world's information in seconds, even using our voice, we are kind of changing as a species, right? So how big of a shift is it from that to maybe it's in my glasses to maybe it's embedded in my retina or, you know, whatever. So his argument is we're going to sort of ultimately merge with these technologies and become, in essence, superhuman compared to who we've been. And that moment he sort of describes as the singularity. That's the fun science fiction-y side. But it has, whatever you think about where it all ends up, we are going through this period of very profound change. And it has a lot of positive effects and has a lot of negative effects. And it changes so fast that it can be very difficult to keep up as a society and as a species. Whether it's, are we going to put such massive numbers of people out of work with automation so quickly that we're going to have things like a basic living wage for everyone, whether or not they're working or we have jobs for them or not, just as an example. And there are many other things. You see the effects of social media on our psyches, on our elections, on our civil discourse. So it's a book worth checking out to get yourself in tune with. Things are getting a little bit crazy and we got to be thoughtful about how we deal with that. That's one. The other, I couldn't pick a book, but I love Michael Lewis's books. So Michael Lewis has written books like Liar's Poker, The Big Short, Boomerang, there are many others. And first of all, they're just fun to read. He's a great sort of storyteller and narrator. They're also, there's a lot in his books about like human folly, I think. I don't know how he would describe them, but it's sort of fun stories of people who mean well, and then maybe they get a little bit greedy and things get away from them. And then there's a lot of effects that we didn't count on. And so it's fascinating to look at how ambition and drive and groupthink sometimes can turn into some really bad outcomes, perhaps, that we got to try and be more thoughtful about before we really hurt ourselves.
Right. Well, good. Those are some books that no one that I've interviewed has mentioned. So that's always great to get some new material. Tell me a little bit. I know you're a technology guy. You love technology, and it sounds like you probably have some favorite tools, technology that has helped you more productive. Anything that you'd share that's you use on a regular basis?
Well, let's see. I'd say as a category, I try and do everything digitally from the start. So if I'm in a meeting taking notes, I'll try and get them into Evernote, for example, right? Or just get things digital from the start. Things are moving so fast. There's no time for going back through handwritten notes and transcribing into something else. And, you know, so tools like Evernote and Trello and, you know, just capture it digitally from the start. And that's the only way you have even a hope of keeping up these days. Sure. I'd say there's that. Password managers. I won't mention which one I use because, you know, no, I don't want to help the hackers, but I think password managers are fantastic. So you can have much, you know, stronger passwords and manage them centrally is good. And I remember this has been quite a while now, probably 20 years, whenever TiVos came out. You remember when TiVo first came out? And yep. I thought, man, this is great. And I couldn't wrap my head around what was so great about it. But it's time shifting, right? It's sure. More control. So now it's like, it's no big deal, right? We just stream whatever we want through, you know, Apple TV or what have you. But that ability to shape and shift the world to your timing and your choice is fabulous, right? Helps us. We're just living differently these days.
Absolutely. So yeah. Outside of work, we've talked a lot with leaders that it's important to have a life outside of work and to refresh. What do you enjoy doing outside of your work hours?
I was better at doing things outside of work before I started a company. Can't take full candor. I am a private pilot, so which okay. is a lot of fun. Instrument rated pilot. And when you're up there flying the airplane, you, uh, you don't think about anything else, sure. which is wonderful because you're focused on keeping yourself alive, which is important. And there's a moment in every pilot's life or sort of journey when you've just learned to solo, you're just up doing your, it could be your second solo flight, maybe your third. And you have a moment where you feel like it's getting the better of you. You're behind the airplane, the weather's too much, you're freaking out a little bit. And then you realize, well, there's only one way this plane's getting back on the ground in one piece, and that's if I fly this airplane, right? And you must overcome that moment of panic and forge ahead. And it wasn't long ago in the daily ups and downs of having an early stage company when it dawned on me that, you know, there's a parallel to what it takes to build a company. There are days when, you know, boy, it's a long way down and this is really hard. And there are up days as well, of course. But there's a parallel, like, you know, you just have to keep going. So anyway, that was a fun kind of connection. But used to fly my airplane, haven't been doing much other than work these days. I'm ashamed to admit, but when I'm not working, I'm at home with my wife and try and get a little downtime and, you know, get a little exercise in. But yeah, a lot of work in these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, any parting advice that you'd give somebody that's maybe starting as a leader in new role?
You know, I thought about this in preparing for our call today, and, you know, our modern society there's so much instant gratification, right? You can get whatever you want whenever you want it, whether that's a game or some entertainment or, you know, it's easy to travel or what. It's real easy to get yourself to a place of sort of temporary fulfillment, if you know, and satisfaction of what you want at that time. And that's good. I mean, we should have very multidimensional lives and so on. But I think that people really have to, young people even today, need to realize that there's a lot of work involved in becoming your best self. You know, you really got to lean into that. You got to be really driven. You got to go the extra mile. It's more than just showing up to work. It's more than just getting a degree and getting a credential. And I'm fortunate in my company, I have a number of passionate, motivated young people working in this company. And each of them is, you know, they're all very different, but each of them has their own sense of like who they are and what's driving them. And that's what it takes. Like, you know, this is not about sitting back and letting the world sort of drag you along on the current. You got to swim. You know, you got to really swim and be focused and dedicated to where you're going. So I would say resist all of the modern conveniences that can waste all of your time. Again, whether it's video games or movies or entertainment or your favorite playlist or whatever, get out there and swim hard against the current. Know who you are, or at least work at figuring out who you are. And if you really lean in that way, you can make your best contribution to the world. Kind of back to Todd's book and Die Empty, which I really encourage people to read. It's a fabulous book.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.